morning, Your Honors. I'm John Vetney. I'm counsel for the almond growers.
If I could start on a light note, you have one of the most impressive business addresses I've ever seen. For people in the court who don't recognize it, it's 11 Red Sox Lane.
It engenders animosity in some circles.
none here. Although I shouldn't speak for my colleagues.
That's an address in New Hampshire. I represent California growers of almonds and California growers who also retail their product to consumers. There are two issues involved, one involving the right of growers to seek review for actions that they claim violate the limited authority given to the Secretary of Agriculture under 1935 Act that was reenacted in 1937 as the Agricultural Marketing Agreement Act.
Can I ask you about the plaintiffs? Do you represent, maybe it's not in the record, do you represent any growers who are not organic growers?
Yes, some of the appellant growers, the farmers, are organic and some are not.
So we do have some producers who don't want to use this or have to use this process, but not because they want to sell them raw. Is that right?
There is no distinction in the regulations,
right,
between organic and non-organic growers.
Okay.
There are growers who have decided not to have their farm certified as organic, who nevertheless have a market or had a market for raw almonds, or who want a market for raw almonds, or who want to retail their own crops. There are both involved here. Organic producers go through extra special means to make sure their crops are not artificially enhanced by certain pesticides and that kind of thing. It is not really relevant to the claims here. The two claims are, one, to growers. Are growers precluded from challenging action of the Secretary? And that was decided, although there have been decades of confusion in this court, that was decided by this circuit last year in the Arkansas Dairy case. The Arkansas Dairy case is now law of this circuit. It clarifies the ambiguity in decisions. It is stare decisis, and I found a quote from a case that I didn't cite, but I like it. Stare decisis means nothing if we are only bound by those cases with which we already agree. So, two of you might recognize that.
How about sui generis? I mean, that's another phrase, and the milk producers are the only ones who can fix prices. I mean, I just see Arkansas Dairy as not answering this question.
I have no clue in what respect it does not answer the question, because the question addressed in Arkansas Dairy involved looking at two legal propositions or two laws. One, the decision of the Supreme Court in Community Nutrition Institute v. Block, and other looking at 5 U.S.C. Section 701, which says persons are entitled to come to court if they're aggrieved or harmed unless a statute precludes review. In C&I v. Block, well, let's go back to Barlow v. Collins and Association of Data Processors and Abbott's Laboratories. Barlow v. Collins in particular says, if there is a class protected by a statute, members of that class should be able to sue if their protection is claimed to be violated. In C&I v. Block, before the Supreme Court, Block v. C&I in the Circuit Court, the Supreme Court held that consumers as a class are precluded by statute from challenging marketing orders. The Supreme Court expressly referred to Barlow v. Collins and to prior decisions that said producers are protected by the statute. They can bring action to protect their rights. Almond growers are producers. Barlow v. Collins says if there's a class protected, you get to come to court, and Section 701 of 5 U.S.C. says, unless specifically precluded. In the Abbott's Laboratories case, the Supreme Court phrased the question.
Can I interrupt you for a second? In ethylene dairy, didn't we say that the nature of the injury has to be a personal nature, that it can't be simply plaintiffs trying to have the regulatory process under review, but that there's an actual statutory right that they've been denied, right? And Arkansas Dairy emphasized that as well. What is the statutory right that the producers here have been denied?
Oh, well, one thing, the producers claim that they're entitled to vote in a referendum. The complaint alleges that they were not allowed to vote in a referendum. The secretary denied them a referendum for an extraordinary change in the regulations. The system of regulation in marketing orders is there is a formal hearing under 5 U.S.C. Section 556 and 7, same as adjudication, but it's a rulemaking process. It's sort of an unusual exception to the rulemaking process. It's not a 554 process. After that formal hearing, the secretary presents his new rules, his new proposed rules to growers or producers for referendum. Two-thirds of them have to approve in order for the rules to become regulation. There's also another wrinkle. Handlers, the middlemen who buy, also can vote in a referendum. But that's Section 607 U.S.C. 608C8. Handlers can vote in a referendum and agree in a contract term to marketing order. Then you have a marketing agreement and a marketing order. But if 50% of handlers don't agree, the secretary under Section 9, 5 U.S.C. Section 608C9, can nevertheless make the regulations effective if producers approve, two-thirds of producers, and the secretary finds that the regulations proposed are the only practical means of protecting producer interests, grower interests. The only practical means standard, which the Supreme Court actually in the Block case said, it's an extra burden for the secretary. There was no referendum. There has been no only practical means finding for the regulations in effect. In fact, it derives back to 1976, when handlers, in fact, approved of the regulations, so there was no need for an only practical means finding. The retail regulations date back to 1950, when the secretary could regulate retail activities because handlers approved. From 1996 forward, handlers have not approved of this particular regulation. That brings into effect Section 13, 608C13, which precludes the secretary, only in cases where handlers have not approved, from regulating retailers in their retailer capacity. The retailer section that the retailers challenge dates back before 1996, and some form of retail regulation was in place from 1950 to 1996. The problem is that the secretary retained, didn't even bother to look at the retail regulations that were in place in the order, and USDA admits that since 1996, the secretary may not regulate retail activities. Now, the retail activities.
It's odd that Congress would devise a scheme whereby handlers have to exhaust, but producers can go directly to court.
Not at all.
And why
not,
is that?
Not at all. The history of that exhaustion was in the 1933 Act. In fact, the Alto Dairy case, which Edeline expressly indicated intent to be consistent with. In Alto Dairy, Judge Posner went at some length through the history of the 1933 Act, the 1935 Act, the Stark versus Wickard in 1943, and the adoption of the APA provision allowing review unless precluded a couple of years after Stark, explaining that after that there's no reason for Congress to look at it because now we have express review unless expressly precluded. Again, there has been no case that says producers as a class are precluded. CNI v. Block said, Block v. CNI said, consumers as a class are expressly precluded. Courts, including prior decisions of this circuit, have tried to rewrite the legislation by saying, oh, in this circumstance, producers can seek review, in other circumstances, they cannot. The Abbott's Laboratory cases say, unless specifically precluded. In fact, it says, don't ask if it's authorized. That is not the question. Ask if it's precluded. It is not precluded. The question becomes, and part of this concern is, can producers be exploited to be surrogates for handlers? And the question is really one of standing. If a producer comes before a district court and complains, and really the complaint is about something that affects handlers and doesn't affect producers, that's a factual inquiry. It's a standing question. It's an injury question. It can be answered as a standing question. Does the producer state a claim for which relief can be granted to that producer? For a producer that has both capacities as a handler and a producer, really it's a question of, well, whether it's an alter ego. Derry Lee, Alto, Edeline, all involved claims in which there was capacity of a handler and a producer, and both said, or all three said, Lehigh Valley, same thing.
What about your, let's put aside the growers, let's talk about the grower retailers
yes,
for
please.
A second.
I'd love to.
How are we supposed to analyze them in this case? In what capacity are they suing, as growers or as retailers, and what difference does that make?
Well, they join in all the growers in the grower claims, and they have unique claims as retailers. They are the only retailers that seek protection of the statutory prohibition against retail regulation in Section 13 of the AMAA. So they have both capacities. This is the first case in the history of the AMAA that involves that retail prohibition. Retailers have no administrative remedy. These retailers have never been handlers, never claim to be handlers, never seek relief from a decision by the Secretary that they are handlers, although USDA has asserted facts to the contrary, which the lower court deferred to. It is not true. It's not in the complaint. They are retailers. They are grower retailers, which are exempted, that have farm stand sales and meet that definition.
And a pure retailer could sue directly as well, correct?
Pure retailer could sue if the secretary tried to regulate that retail activity, yes.
Right.
I think because it's a protected class under Barlow. It's a class specifically protected for which there is no administrative remedy. They aren't handlers, and USDA in so many circumstances where a non-regulated, somebody who wasn't a regulated handler, they've denied it to unregulated plants that handle milk. They've denied administrative standing to producers. They've denied administrative standing to trade associations. They denied administrative standing to Secretary Ann Veneman when she was Secretary of Agriculture in California, former Secretary Ann Veneman. Standing in USDA is specifically limited to regulated handlers. Judge Posner in Alto, by the way, gave USDA a roadmap to cure this problem. Write some rules to provide some administrative remedies for producers, for others. And in that case, if you have administrative remedies available, the prudential exhaustion for the remedies that you provide will be applied by the court. But you can't at the same time deny a process which is available to you by regulation and simultaneously say there is no process in court. It's one or the other. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time. I'd love to answer some questions, but.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Abate.
May it please the court, I'm Michael Abate on behalf of the Secretary of Agriculture. Judge Kavanaugh, I'd like to begin by starting with your question, your first question to Mr. Vetney. I think it would be odd indeed to permit producers who are given no administrative or judicial rights under this statute to proceed directly to court to make the same challenges to the Salmonella rule.
But it's really odd to preclude them from court altogether.
Well, no, Your Honor, I don't think it is, and I think the rationale of Block teaches us.
Well, Block's about consumers, though.
Block is about consumers, Your Honor. However, I think when
every consumer could sue, as Judge Boggs said in his opinion for the Sixth Circuit, that would be unthinkable. But it's not at all unthinkable to conclude that producers can sue.
Well, I think that this case is very different for the reason that Judge Henderson pointed out, which is that the interests of the producers and the handlers outside the context of milk are aligned in a way that they are not in those cases that the plaintiffs have cited in their briefs. This is not a case like milk where you have handlers and producers fighting over the division of the blended price. In Arkansas Dairy, for example, it was make allowances. And in Stark, similarly, what was going on was
I like the distinction you're making based on alignment, but that didn't seem to be of great interest to the majority in Arkansas Dairy, did it?
Well, to the contrary, Your Honor, I think that's exactly what the majority in Arkansas Dairy looked at.
They just looked at the structure of the statute, than the alignment argument.
No, Your Honor, I think at page 823 in the Arkansas Dairy opinion, this court said, quote, producer and handler interests are normally adverse. And that really underlay the decision in that case. And at 823, this court also recognized that, therefore, the producers were the only party that could challenge.
So suppose there were a case where the producers were somewhat adverse, or at least had slightly different interests than the handlers. Could the case go forward?
I suppose if there were a rule, and I will say I'm not sure what that rule looks like.
Well, that's part of my problem with your position. We're bound by Arkansas Dairy, and so we're going to devise, under your position in this case, some rule that's going to be a case-by-case inquiry into the different interests of producers and handlers?
Well, I don't think this court necessarily has to undertake a case-by-case inquiry, but
I need a clear rule from you on that.
Even if that is the case, I will say that we think that is the preferable rule, because it is undeniably clear that the contrary rule in this case will always allow handlers to evade and make an end run around the exhaustion requirement. In the Allman context,
because you have a broader point, but I'm focused. You just said it would always allow handlers to evade. Why is that?
Well, for the point that I was making, that it's not clear to me what the rule looks like that in the Allman context disadvantages producers and doesn't also affect handlers in some way that they would be able to bring suit. Mr. Vetney pointed to a possible argument here, and I want to...
Well, a pure handler would have to exhaust.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct, but...
So that doesn't allow the handler to evade the exhaustion requirement.
Well,
a producer could sue directly.
But I think this is a perfect example of why in practice it wouldn't play out that way, Your Honor. There are four sets of original plaintiffs in this case, two of which they would concede have administrative remedies, three of which we think have administrative remedies. They've brought the same set of claims in the same lawsuit.
Making the Block circumvention argument?
That's exactly the argument we're making, Your Honor. And the Supreme Court focused on that intently and said it would be very weird to allow the handler to enlist any consumer simply to make an end run around the exhaustion requirement. And that is exactly what would happen here.
So what was more important in Block, the fact that it was consumers or the alignment argument that you're making now?
I think it was the alignment argument. I think they're both important to the court's decision, and we're not arguing that the court in Block wasn't concerned about the fact that they were consumers. Mm-hmm. But the rationale, and I mean, the court lays this out very clearly at page 352 of the opinion in Block, where they talk about how the handlers can be expected to challenge the regulations. And the same is true in this instance. Now, Mr. Vetney's specific example here was a concern that there was no referendum and vote for the growers. And I want to explain that's actually intricately tied up with the handler's interest in this case. There were six causes of action in the complaint. Four of the six were all, I think, variations on a theme that goes as following. The marketing order allowed, and they concede this in their papers, the marketing order allowed the board, with the approval of the secretary, to institute quality control regulations. And their argument is this goes beyond quality control. Therefore, it couldn't be done as an administrative regulation. That triggers the voting and referendum requirements under 608C9, and therefore this whole thing was invalid. Now, that claim has been advanced by the handlers, that this exceeded the quality control regulations. Judge Huval found, and I believe it was footnote 8 of her opinion, that this voting and referendum claim was, in fact, advanced by the handlers in this case.
But this, your focus on the complaint, and I understand why you're doing it, really points up the problem going forward. It's going to be a mess.
Well, Your Honor,
we're going to have such a unclear line that producers, there's going to be litigation, never going to know when they can get into court. There's going to be ways to get into the Arkansas dairy box and then into this box. It just doesn't make any sense that I can see that we would draw the line you're advancing here.
Well, Your Honor, I think the Supreme Court did exactly that in Block, where they looked to the typical alignment that can be expected between the consumer and the producer.
Block does not consider producers, correct?
Block does not consider
producers. And Judge Scalia, then Judge Scalia in his dissent in the D.C. Circuit, took it as a given that producer suits could go forward, in his opinion.
It was, yes, but the majority opinion, of course, does not go so far. And I think that while admittedly, as you pointed out, there could be confusion at the extreme of our rule where some action by the secretary that I can't yet identify and nobody has identified would affect producers uniquely, while that may be a difficult conceptual problem, it is clear that the contrary rule advocated by the producers would allow evasion of exhaustion in virtually every case under the Almond Order. You do not have the tensions between the handlers and the producers here. All we have are quality control regulations.
I take your point that the exhaustion requirement may be whittled down, but is it worse from the perspective of looking at this to have an exhaustion requirement whittled down or to have a whole class of people who are directly affected by an agency rule who are barred not only from the administrative process but from court altogether?
Well, again, Your Honor, we don't think that realistically that's going to happen. We think the producers and the handlers can be expected in this context to have aligned interests that will be advanced by the handlers in administrative remedies and in the courts. And that's
exactly what could happen. If they thought it was good enough, they would just go through the exhaustion process.
Well,
right?
No, I don't think that's a fair assumption, Your Honor, because I think that...
Right, because they think that
they could have exhausted
time and they want to go... They're not going to get any relief out of it, they assume.
I don't want to put words into the mouth of the opposing party, but they could have simply avoided all of this by going to the agency in the first instance and exhausting every one of these claims. I don't think anybody disputes that the handlers could have put forward all of these substantive arguments to the agency, which could have adjudicated it, and it may well be on the merits in district court by now, if not on its way to this court on appeal, assuming they didn't prevail in front of the agency, which they might have. So I think it's fair to say that it is clear ruling for the plaintiffs in this case will allow end runs in virtually, if not every case. And while we won't dispute that there could be a hypothetical rule at the margin that would bring Arkansas Dairy into play, we think that that case, the theoretical possibility of that case, should not define this court's prudential rule in construing what is going on under the statute. And I want to make one final point on this, in particular to the point about voter and producer referendums. Congress in 2008 in the Farm Bill actually amended the AMAA in a very important way here. What they did is they added section 608C17E. And in 17E, they created a provision that allows the secretary to amend, not just issue regulations, but amend marketing orders without using the formal voting procedure, using notice and comment rulemaking, as long as it does not affect the pricing of milk. And when they did that, they did not create a corresponding right for the producers to come into court and challenge that. And I think that further demonstrates that Congress is aware that milk, as Judge Henderson was pointing out, is a very unique context that has different pitting of interests between all the players in the scheme. And it has allowed these other sorts of changes going forward to be made informally and nonetheless has not given any more rights.
This producer issue has been kicking around for two decades and there's a circuit split. Do you know if Congress has contemplated making clear what the rule should be with respect to producers?
I do not know of any legislative proposals that have been made, Your Honor. I can't speak authoritatively to what Congress has or hasn't considered doing, but nonetheless, it is clear that the statute as written today provides these rights to the handlers and not to the producers. And were we to allow producers to proceed directly to court, it seems that the administrative exhaustion remedy would be more or less gutted. And then
isn't another way to look at the statute to say that it wasn't intended to preclude producers from suing, but it was intended to make clear that handlers had to exhaust before suing?
No, I don't think that's right, Your Honor. And I think if you look at cases like Stark, for example, or this court's opinion in Arkansas Dairy, it actually drew an important distinction about the specific claims of the producers in that case. In Stark, for example, it said the producers aren't merely complaining about the blend price. They were complaining specifically about how that price was divvied up their discrete and personal interests. And I think that suggests, in a larger sense, that were they merely complaining about the larger regulatory apparatus, the blend price that applies to handlers and producers, that there may not have been a cause of action there. But you had to drill down to see the specific nature. And I think the same is here. The complaint is about...
The specific complaint in this case is ultimately about the process that producers are going to have to use for almonds that they grow, correct?
Well, the producers don't have to do anything to the almonds, and I think that's important. The handlers treat. The producers are not in any way regulated.
Yes.
And so that's another reason why it makes sense for the handlers, who have to do the treating, to be the ones in the agency and in court. Now, if I may briefly, before I get too far along, turn to the second set of issues here, which is the producer retailers.
Before you do that, I want to ask you about Stark, and the reason I asked the opposing counsel about the organic farmers versus the majority. If there were a case that the non-organic farmers of almonds, growers of almonds, were trying to run the organic growers out of business, is that the type of case that you would say Stark might let, even though Stark was milk, might let them come into court because of the equities involved? How would you, if that were the situation, what would you say the producers, the organic farmers, would be able to do under this statute?
Well, I think the answer to that question is still the same as the one we're proposing for this reason. The dispute there wouldn't be between producers and handlers via producers and handlers. It would be different types of producers and different types of handlers. And the people who handle the organic almonds, much like the people who handle the non-organic almonds, you know, would have an interest in preserving the market for organics, as the handlers who sued in this case did, and there would still be somebody with aligned interests to exhaust those remedies. So it doesn't seem that would be a dispute between producers. It would be between producers, and similarly between handlers, not producers versus handlers.
Would it automatically sweep in the handlers as well?
Well, yes, I think it would, because those producers are selling their almonds to somebody, a handler, who then is turning around and selling them to the market. So they're being handled before retail, unless, and this I think dovetails nicely with the point I was just going to make, unless in fact they're selling at a roadside stand. I think the answer to the question about the producer retailers, as plaintiffs have called it, is that they can't have it both ways. Either they are selling in excess of the roadside stand limit, in which case they're handlers by definition under the regulation, or, as I understood Mr. Ventney to say this morning, they're selling less than the roadside stand limit, in which case they have really no beef at all here because they don't have to comply with the treatment regulation. If they're not exceeding those limits, they're not handling, and they can sell them without treating. So I don't understand how that group of plaintiffs gets into court. And I will point out that, contrary to what was represented, their complaint really strongly implies the opposite. Paragraph 42 of their complaint says, and I'll quote, "In the event that almond growers choose to market their almond production themselves, those actions alone convert the growers into handlers of almonds subject to the regulations set forth in the almond order." And that, to me, strongly suggests that the reason that they believe they're aggrieved is that they are selling in excess of the roadside stand limits, and therefore they're aggrieved. If not, I think it's a much easier case because, you know, they don't have to treat at all, so they should definitely not have the right to circumvent the exhaustion requirement and come straight to court.
There are all these exceptions about the production area, which is the state of California, right?
Correct. The almond order only applies in California. Nearly 100% of the almonds grown in this country
That's
are grown in California.
So we've got raw almonds still sold outside this country.
Almonds imported from outside the country.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, I thought there's an exception here.
Yes, the producers can sell their almonds without treating them either to handlers who will treat or outside the country, as long as it's not within, it has to go beyond Mexico or Canada, has to be imported abroad so that it can't be re-imported back into the country. But yes, they may sell them abroad without
treating. Are raw almonds imported into this country and sold?
Correct, Your Honor, and that is by virtue of the fact that USDA's authority is limited to regulating the handlers in this instance within the growing area. They don't regulate the retail sales.
And that's one of the problems that's underlying this case, right? The economic disadvantage that comes from the restrictions on American growers versus foreign growers.
It certainly is something the plaintiffs have pointed to, Your Honor, yes, but that is, of course, a function of the statute where Congress wrote it. And I think reasonably so, that if Congress chooses to regulate handling is the middle point between the growing and the retail of all the almonds.
It just underscores that the producers here are being severely economically harmed, and yet they don't get to complain in court that the regulation is illegal.
Well, Your Honor, but the handlers, of course, can bring that claim and have brought that claim.
I understand, but they may be economically disadvantaged in other ways, but a lot of the growers are going to be small growers that are going to be run out of business by the effect of this regulation without any access to court at all.
Well, if I may just point out very briefly, in the Supreme Court's opinion in Block, it noted in footnote 3, importantly, that it didn't matter if the handlers in that case ultimately passed all the savings on to the consumers. The important point for whether or not the claim was precluded was that they shared an interest in challenging the regulation, and therefore the scheme wouldn't be frustrated. So that the producers and the handlers may be affected in different ways does not negate the Block rationale. In fact, Block called that, quote, irrelevant.
It's very unusual to say in our administrative law system that, well, someone else is going to be negatively affected, so the fact that I'm run out of business is okay because they'll challenge it for me.
Well, Your Honor, admittedly there are lots of competing interests in this statute, but Congress set it up in the way it did, and the Supreme Court in Block held that it was very important to prevent end runs around the administrative exhaustion. And I will just briefly end where I started to say I think it would be odd indeed to permit producers who are given no rights, procedural or judicial under the statute, to proceed directly to court while requiring the handlers who were given the rights to go to the agency first. Mm-hmm. If this court has no further questions, thank you.
Okay. You have 1 minute, Mr. Bittman.
Yes, I'd like to briefly address the last comment. Congress set it up the way it did. The reason there have been so many differences in this circuit and other circuits on producer right to court is because the courts have looked to court decisions and have looked to other court decisions. It's like a rumor. It's the statute. How did Congress set it up? And Congress set it up in 1935 so that handlers could seek review. And that was the end of what Congress said. But in that same act of August 24, 1935, Congress expressly precluded judicial review for processing taxes under the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1933. Congress knew how to preclude in that same statute. It did not do so with respect to the marketing order provision. The producers, the growers.
But we've never required that sort of express preclusion, right? Our case law says we look beyond that. We look at the structure of the statute.
It's a statutory construction. Right. And one thing that you look at when you construct a statute is the statute and what else is contained in that statute. The grower, the retailers do not seek and have never sought, as counsel for the government said, to sell in excess of the roadside stand limit. There is no question about the roadside stand limit. It allows the sale of 100 pounds per day, per person, for home use.
I think counsel then followed up by saying, if that's true, what are you complaining about with respect to the roadside?
What we're complaining about is that we must sell only at the roadside stand. It's not what's defined as retail. It's where we can retail. We can't have a roadside stand in Nevada. We can't have one in Massachusetts. We can't sell on the internet.
You want to retail beyond the limits set by the roadside stand limit.
Absolutely. And that roadside stand limit is precisely what Section 13 precludes the Secretary from continuing after 1996 when Section 13 became effective because handlers no longer approved of the order. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.